A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Maven, concentrate on Sin. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar. That's the display department. With a torch. The lights are probably gone. So had the stairs.
You are just number six.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 14. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and today we are talking about Robin of Sherwood. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon from England.
The series opens with Robin of Locksley as a five-year-old child in the village of Locksley, which is destroyed by the Sheriff of Nottingham and his men. Robin's parents, his family, nearly everyone he knows are killed. He is sent to live with a miller and the miller's son, and so it starts. Many years later, the adult Robin is, of course, Robin Hood. He rises up against his oppressors, and he is called to do so and called to serve the people by the forest god, Herne the Hunter.
Robin of Sherwood was a 1980s British TV series that was shown as 26 one-hour episodes, which were shown in three series between 1984 and 1986. And it was shown on the commercial television channel ITV. It was a Saturday night show, and it was quite a big budget show. They'd put a lot of money and effort into making it a fairly important show about Robin Hood. And it certainly had all the classic elements of Robin Hood. But I think, as we'll discuss, they added lots more historical context. And also, for the first time, they added a very fantasy, magical, mystical approach to the legend of Robin Hood.
It was a combination of what you expect in Robin Hood with a much more historical feel to it, and with this fantasy element. It was a change from Robin Hood wearing green felt and a pointy hat to something that was much more historical.
One of the first fantasy elements we encounter in the series that Brian has already mentioned is this character, Herne the Hunter, who's a sort of a spirit of the forest. And it's quite clever. I think this was the first time that had been linked to the Robin Hood legend, that they brought another bit of British mythology, the sort of the hunt's god or a forest spirit. Although the legend of Herne the Hunter probably comes after Robin Hood in terms of history, but certainly he's got elements of other fantasy spirits and forest gods involved in him. And we see him in the series. Sometimes he's portrayed as just a man, but other times he's a very sort of mystical spirit character who appears to Robin and really gives him his calling.
The legend of Herne the Hunter is a man with the antlers of a deer. They actually took that a step further in this series and had a man with the entire head of a deer and the full antlers, which made for a pretty striking image for Herne the Hunter. At the beginning of the series, Herne comes to Robin of Locksley and chooses him, and Robin becomes Herne's son. And it was really the chosen one of Herne. It wasn't done in a messianic sort of way. It was done in the way that Robin was chosen to do Herne's bidding and to serve Herne, and to have, in a certain sense, power brought to him by Herne. And it was said very early on in the first couple of episodes that if Robin does not survive, then Herne will choose another, and there will be another Herne's son.
And the other thing that said again in the first episode was is very much Herne is giving Robin sort of a job to do, but almost like a task, that he's been chosen to protect the poor and the dispossessed and the hungry. He's very much been given a calling by Herne. As we've said, one of the big differences about this version of Robin Hood is the amount of myth and magic that the creators included in the show. Very early on, again, right in the first episodes, we encounter the traditional archery contest, which features in lots of Robin Hood versions. And as usual, the prize is a silver arrow. But in this telling of Robin Hood, the silver arrow is more than just a valuable prize. It actually has symbolic and magical value, and is Herne's arrow. And Robin, when he wins the arrow, returns it to Herne, and it has a great deal of power attached to it. The other elements of magic were introduced as the show went along, and it was quite clear that in this Robin Hood, magic works. Quite unusually, although I think probably fairly accurate for the time period they were portraying, we see an awful lot of pagan ritual going on and being accepted as part of normal life alongside Christianity, which is quite an interesting part of the show. Later on, we'll even encounter bits and pieces of Arthurian legend in the third series.
You had people being possessed by sorcerers. You had witches causing harm to people. You had all sorts of things. There is also a magically enchanted sword called Albion that Robin wields. Part of the power of this sword is that it cannot slay Herne's son. And it adds power and adds fight to what Robin can do. The characters of Robin of Sherwood were the classic Robin Hood characters, as well as a few others. You had Robin of Locksley, or Robin Hood, played by Michael Praed, and he was a very young Robin Hood, as all of the characters tended to be quite young in this version. I believe the actor was about 23 when the series started, and he was a very young, idealistic version of Robin Hood who really wanted to help the people and really believed. And of course, you also had Marion of Leiford, who was also very young and had an aristocratic background. Right near the beginning of the series, again, I think in the first episode, Marion and Robin are married, and this is what puts Marion out of favor. She's very much one of the outlaws.
We also, wherever we find Robin Hood, we will find his right-hand man, John Little, or Little John, who was played by an actor called Clive Mantle, a very tall, imposing actor who's probably best known on British television for playing a doctor in a very long-running medical series called Casualty. But I think American audiences may remember him as the nuclear man in Superman 4.
Oh dear, I had forgotten about that.
Yes, it's probably worth forgetting about. We also have other characters from the Merry Men. We have Friar Tuck, played by Phil Rose, who'd not done an awful lot of film or TV work, but he fitted the part of the very stocky monk character, Friar Tuck. And we have another character from Robin Hood legend, which is Will Scarlet, or Will Scathlock, as he's sometimes known in the legends. He was played by Ray Winston. He was a professional soldier. He'd been fighting in France, and he'd become disillusioned with authority, particularly because, obviously, as we find out in the series, some of the Norman rulers of England at the time had killed his wife. And so he has become an outlaw, and he meets Robin in jail right at the start. Ray Winston's a very famous actor now, but this, I think, was one of his first TV roles. And he certainly is very young in this, as most of the cast were, as you said.
He was always angry. He had this sort of seething anger just below the surface. He also tended to lock horns with Little John. The two of them were jockeying for who was the number two man in this group. He would also argue and fight with Robin as to who was the number one person in this band of rebels. A new character that was introduced by this series, Robin of Sherwood, was Nazir, played by Mark Ryan. Nazir was a Saracen who came from the East, presumably somehow through the Crusades, and spoke very little English. At the beginning, he said his name, and that was about all he ever said. He was a very good fighter who fought with two swords that he had clipped onto his back. He was part of the archery competition that was where Robin ultimately won and won the Silver Arrow. Nazir, at the end of the introductory episodes, decides to leave his employer and join Robin and the others.
Nazir is a fascinating character. I mean, he's very well played. He's if Will Scarlet was a professional soldier, then Nazir was, in a way, a professional killer. He's quite deadly with all his weaponry. And as you say, I don't think he has more than one or two words of dialogue in the whole first series. He's pretty much silent throughout.
Yes, they gradually give him a bit more dialogue, but he's always predominantly silent. Another new character that they added in this particular take on Robin Hood was Much, played by Peter Llewellyn Williams. And Much was almost a brother to Robin. Much was very young, even younger than the others. He was the son of the miller who raised Robin. They were raised as brothers. Much is something of a simple character. He is not stupid. He's sometimes referred to as a half-wit, which he isn't. He added just something a little bit different to things. We also, of course, have our villains, chief among them being Robert Dureno, the Sheriff of Nottingham, played by Nicholas Grace. He was a great villain. He was basically completely insane. He was always losing his temper, constantly shouting at everyone who worked for him, and doing all kinds of things. Very nasty and very angry. He was a villain that was very fun to watch.
Yeah, he takes it to extremes. He is the villain's villain par excellence in this. And as you say, whenever he's on screen, he is actually quite fun and entertaining to watch. The other two main villains were Guy of Gisborne, who was played by an actor called Robert Addy, and he is one of the Norman noblemen who basically serves as the sheriff's right-hand man, although he also serves as the butt of the sheriff's anger for a lot of the time as well, when things inevitably don't go well and he fails yet again to capture Robin Hood and his gang of outlaws. And also we had the sheriff's brother, Abbot Hugo Dureno, who was a man of the church, but he's very much played as a money-grabbing, avaricious man of the church. And he was played by a very recognisable British actor called Philip Jackson, who is basically in British television and films just about all the time. He's very well-known, very good actor.
Abbot Hugo is the representation of all of the corrupt abbots and priests and members of the clergy that show up in different legend and mythology. It worked quite well. It added something a little bit more interesting to the side of the villains. There was this other element that gave you some conflict between the different villains. This was a series that had plenty of inter-character conflict, not just between the villains and the heroes, but also in any given group, there was almost always some conflict somewhere.
Yeah, there's certainly a lot of conflict going on in Robin of Sherwood, as you say, both within the bad guys, but also within the outlaws themselves. And that constant jockeying for position that you've mentioned between Will Scarlet and Little John and Robin Hood himself.
Wolf's Head. Outlaw. Do you fear me, boy?
Why should I fear you? You're a man.
I am your destiny. Her. Herne the Hunter. Look at me. They are all waiting. The blinded, the maimed, the men locked in the stinking dark all wait for you. Children with swollen...
We've mentioned some of the differences of this interpretation of Robin Hood. One that particularly stands out is the historical setting. This production, they really went to a lot of trouble, I think, to get the historical context very accurately done. It's fairly well defined because we have the dates, we have the succession that happens during the series of King Richard to King John. And it is interesting that when King Richard turns up in the first series, I think he's played much more like the accurate version of King Richard. I think when they, in previous and in subsequent versions of Robin Hood, they've tended to portray good King Richard as this fantastical character who will turn up at the end of the play, as it were, to marry Robin Hood and Marian. And that's certainly how he was portrayed when Sean Connery played him. Historically, the version in this interpretation is much more like the real version. He's played by John Rhys-Davies, who we probably remember as Gimli the Dwarf in the Lord of the Rings films, and as, of course, he plays Sala in the Indiana Jones movies. And when he turns up, he's a very powerful, he's clearly a soldier, he's clearly a very powerful character, but he's quite clearly returned to England just to raise more money and taxes so that he can go back and fight abroad.
There was a very strong sense of history here, and the look and the feel of things we'll talk about a little more, but it really brought a strong sense of that history, and that was really nice. there was also this very strong sense of fantasy in Robin Hood that was anchored by Herne the Hunter. But far from only Herne the Hunter, there were many different fantasy elements that came in from time to time in the series in many different guises, ranging from a couple of different sorcerers to people who served the devil in various ways. There was a lot of variety there and a lot of different things they did.
And as Brian said, they've also, I think for the first time, they've introduced a Saracen character into Robin Hood's band of outlaws. Nasir was the first time that a Saracen was introduced into the Robin Hood legends. And I think they did it because he was originally going to be, I think, just in the opening episodes where he plays the henchman to a rather villainous baron, the Baron de Bellême. But I think they liked the character so much that at the end of the second episode, as Brian said, he actually throws his lot in with Robin Hood and the outlaws. Of course, ever since then, I think most subsequent versions of Robin Hood on television and film have included a Saracen character. Certainly when Kevin Costner's Robin Hood Prince of Thieves came out, there was Morgan Freeman playing a Saracen. And in the recent BBC Robin Hood, which we'll talk about later, there's also a Saracen character as one of the band.
And another thing that they did that was quite new at the time was to have the sheriff be over-the-top, insane, always blowing up and angry. This was something that was pretty new then, and again was reprised in Robin Hood Prince of Thieves with the Alan Rickman version. A number of these kinds of things, like the fantasy element, the Saracen or other Eastern-type character, the insanity of the sheriff, the more historical approach. These are things that have been done in many cases since then, but were not done very much before Robin of Sherwood. I think it introduced a lot of these elements.
Certainly, it's brought in a lot of the elements which now seem to be firm parts of the legend. The look of Robin of Sherwood was very important and very interesting. It was shot almost entirely on locations around the west and north of England. It was produced largely in Bristol in the west of England, and it was shot on 60mm film, so it has a very cinematic look. It looks fantastic, and it stands up very well, even 20 years later. And the sets they chose, or rather the locations they chose, were fantastic, because luckily, of course, England's got a fair supply of castles and cathedrals and abbeys to film in. So we get these fantastic locations that just absolutely look the part.
You have, in addition to these great castles, both for exterior and I think for interior as well, these wonderful outdoor settings where they'd use these wooded, forested areas for Sherwood, and they'd use open fields of different types for villages and other locations. That added to it a great deal.
One of the criticisms often leveled at British television science fiction and fantasy is that the sets aren't very good. Well, certainly with Robin of Sherwood, you can't say that at all, because the sets are fantastic. I mean, apparently, from the production notes, there are a few bits of built scenery and polystyrene walls in there, but I certainly couldn't notice them. Everything looks absolutely correct for the period. And it's quite interesting because the castles, they don't look like fantasy castles. They look like places where people really worked and lived. They're full of straw and chickens, and the forest is full of mud. It's almost like Monty Python and the Holy Grail. There's so much mud around.
They brought it a very unique and interesting visual look to it with their cinematography. There were many shots looking through thickly forested areas, looking upward at the light through the greenery and looking across lakes and ponds, and many things with sunset or a sunrise in the background, often the mist rising off the lake and things like that. The only thing that I find disappointing as a fan of good cinematography is that it was on 16mm film, so it looks just a little soft and grainy on DVD now. Even so, it looked really good.
There's a fantastic scene, I think, in the second series where some horsemen are riding down a hill to attack a village, and they have rather elaborate costumes in order to scare people. And it's shot with a sort of red filter. It's just absolutely fantastic to look at. It's quite an intimidating scene. They also had, I think, very well done costumes. They looked very authentic, the costumes. As Brian said, this is not green tights and silly hats. This looked like people wearing real clothes that had been handmade. And I think they did a very good job with the costumes throughout the three series.
This is one of the advantages you have of the British film and television community, which does so many historical and period pieces that they know how to do things from almost any particular era.
The stunts were well done as well. They were very well filmed, and the sword fights, although I think there were restrictions on what they could show, and they couldn't show an awful lot of blood and people being run through with swords. But certainly the stunts and the weaponry and the fights were very well done. Some of the stylized cinematography they used to film this have apparently become, you know, regular parts of British television, and there are even some shots are now referred to as a Robin of Sherwood shot. Another feature of the Robin of Sherwood series that was very distinctive was the music, the theme tune and the incidental music that was played during the episodes, which was, as far as I know, entirely done by the Irish folk rock band Clannad. I think when people remember the Robin of Sherwood series, it's one of the first things they remember is the distinctive Clannad theme tune and music.
Clannad was a group that was well known to Celtic music fans from the 70s. They did more purely Celtic and traditional Gaelic music in the 70s, and as they got more towards the time that Robin of Sherwood was done, they added a bit more of a pop sound into things, so you had a fusion sound of Celtic with a little pop, a little rock, a little New Agey type of feel to it even, and definitely something that was experimental. Clannad recorded quite a bit of music for Robin of Sherwood, and a lot of it was done in themes that were used repeatedly or full pieces that were used repeatedly.
It sets the scene. It's very haunting and memorable music, and I think it does, you know, it really makes this series stand out. If you like the Clannad music that you hear in Robin of Sherwood, then there's another piece of music of theirs to seek out, which is a theme they did to a television show called Harry's Game. And the piece of music is just called the theme from Harry's Game.
That was actually one of the pieces that got them the job of doing Robin of Sherwood.
I'm not surprised.
They did release an album called Legend, which contained all of their Robin of Sherwood music, I believe, from the first two series. It was released before they did their work for the third series. A lot of the pieces you hear were repeated a number of times. I felt that worked quite well and brought it a wonderful feel. And the experimental side that they had worked very well for some of the battles they did and for some of the evil sorcery things and that sort of thing. They would do things like taking a fork and beating it on the inside of a piano and recording that and using those types of sounds.
Yeah, it's as I say, it's a very important part of Robin and Sherwood.
The ending of the second season of Robin of Sherwood was the first end of the series in many ways. It was a landmark episode because it was when Robin of Locksley died. There was a sequence where the characters were maneuvered into such a situation that Robin knew that the only way out was for him to sacrifice himself and everyone else could survive. Robin basically put himself into a situation where he was surrounded by the Norman soldiers on all sides, and he basically shot them down one by one until he ran out of arrows. And they were still there on all sides. There was a glorious self-sacrifice of Robin being taken down by the Norman soldiers. And it was done in a sequence that in many ways was kind of cheesy with the sunset in the background and everything. But despite that, it was very well done and a very well executed sequence. And the look of that film is just very nice.
It's a fantastic sequence from a fantastic episode, which I think is a fan favorite. And Robin's death was quite a shock. It came as a shock to the viewer. Marion obviously is grief-stricken. I think as we are, as the viewers, we feel her grief because it's such a powerful moment in the series.
Marion is distraught at that point. none of the outlaws actually saw Robin die, but beforehand, Robin said goodbye to Mary, and they never say goodbye to each other, and he left her with Albion, the sword of Hearn's son. At that point, even when she was still standing there with him, she knew that that was the end, that he was going to die.
At that point in the episode, the other outlaws have all been captured by Guy of Gisborne and his men. They're trapped in a hut in a village. The situation looks very grim and gloomy for them as well. It looks like the series is going to end on a terribly downbeat note with the outlaws dying as well. But after Robin's death and Marion and Much's escape, another hooded man character turns up. Very mysterious. We never see his face. Just a hooded man appears and he rescues the outlaws from the hut. And of course, when they see him, they first believe that Robin Hood has survived and that Guy of Gisborne was lying when he told them that he was dead. And then, of course, the hooded man confronts the sheriff and Guy of Gisborne and their men. And they're also convinced that Robin Hood must have returned.
There was a sequence at this point that was also a fantastic sequence where the hooded man emerges after having released the outlaws, the prisoners. The Norman soldiers look at him and believe he is the man that they had just killed after he had killed many of them. There was a sequence where the picture alternated between the hooded man and the image of Robin of Locksley. The hooded man makes one more appearance in the episode where the outlaws are memorializing Robin by shooting flaming arrows into a lake. This was something that reflected the first or the second episode of the series where they were memorializing other people who had died by shooting flaming arrows into the lake. And in that first episode, Nazir appeared and did the same, shot the flaming arrow, and that was how and when he joined the outlaws. Well, in this, the end of the second series, the hooded man appears and shoots the flaming arrow and then leaves. So the outlaws don't know who he is. We, the viewers, don't know who he is.
It was a perfect ending to the second series because it seemed to resolve things but also set things up for the third series.
Well, as that was a cliffhanger between series two and series three, I think we'll leave that as our cliffhanger as well. So we will continue our discussion of Robin of Sherwood on the next episode of British Invaders, and we will talk about the resolution to this cliffhanger and talk about a few other things. You can reach us at britishinvaders@gmail.com and at www.britishinvaders.com. So for the moment, this is Brian from Canada, signing off.
And this is Eamon from England saying goodbye.